Taking Stock on News Talk.
Thanks to Skillnet Ireland, driving business success through innovative training and upskilling.
This is Vincent Wall with you on News Talk's Taking Stock. We're joined now by Daniel Jurgen, Pulitzer Prize winner and author of The New Map, Energy, Climate and Clash of Nations. Daniel, you're very welcome and thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Now, it's a fascinating book, and I suppose one of the key messages from it is that while there are political lines and boundaries on the map, the global map, and most of those haven't changed since the fall of the Soviet Union 30, 40 years ago, there's a different map, and it's delineated by changing power relationships and dependencies, and they're shaped in many occasions by energy resources and requirements.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, what I've tried to do with calling the book The New Map was a sense that there is a new map of both energy and geopolitics, and those two things are interacting, ranging from, you know, the change in the position of the United States to climate to changing relations with China.
China is a key factor in this new 21st century map, Daniel, not just because it is rapidly becoming the world's biggest economy with huge energy needs, but also because it's very sensitive to the fact that it's vulnerable on its energy requirements and in many ways is stretching out beyond its borders to try to reduce that vulnerability while also trying to increase its own renewable resources within.
Yes. You're speaking about China, and China has the growth of the Chinese economy has taken it from being self-sufficient in oil to being basically dependent for 75% of its oil on imports, many of which come through the South China Sea, which is a very controversial body of water. But China is also, at the same time, is pushing renewables. Half the wind in the world, half the solar in the world is in China. And in a sense, for China, energy is about everything, but it wants to reduce its dependence on coal, which is now almost 60% of its total energy and is really an inheritance of decades and decades of central planning.
And do you believe that this view of its energy requirements over the decades ahead is dictating to some degree its diplomatic and geopolitical strategies, not just the Belt and Road, where it's investing in other countries to get port infrastructure, the likes of that, but also its very aggressive attitude to the South China Sea and the Key Magellan Straits?
Yeah, I think that China has both major economic objectives and major geopolitical objectives. And with what is called its Belt and Road strategy, which is this notion of connecting Central Asia, South Asia, Africa, and Europe with the Chinese economy, certainly has a major political dimension about its role in the world. And it's adopted a very strong position on the South China Sea, claiming that body of water through which passes one-third of world trade every day, claiming it as its own, and the other nations around there, and the United States, and Britain, and Australia, don't accept that at all. So, and of course, it's changed the position of Hong Kong. So you kind of see a kind of polarization developing, very different from 5 or 6 years ago when it seemed that that people talked about China being integrated into a global community. Now it's almost as though maybe two global communities are emerging.
Another key factor in this new map that you sketch out, that's evolving all the time, of course, starts from a very remote location in a small town in Texas, and how that has changed the geopolitical and energy needs of the United States.
Well, it is remarkable. You know, sometimes, Vincent, come from big forces and big organizations, and sometimes it just comes from stubborn individuals. And there was one stubborn individual named George Mitchell, who was not an oil man, he was a gas man, and he believed that you could get natural gas out of this very dense rock called shale. And everybody said, "You're crazy, you're wasting your money. The textbooks say it's impossible." And he stuck at it for 18 years. And after 18 years, in this little town called Dish, Texas, population a few hundred, the first shale well was drilled, and everybody thought it was a joke and not amount to anything. But you know what? It really changed the energy world, because the United States, which had imported 60% of its oil, which was the world's largest importer of oil, instead became and has become the world's largest producer of oil. And suddenly it produces more oil than Russia and produces more oil than Saudi Arabia. And that really changes the global energy markets. And I think, again, going to your earlier comments, Vincent, changes geopolitics.
And in many ways, it changes geopolitics, Daniel, in the sense that dependencies change. So because the U.S. has become, in a way, much more self-sufficient for its oil and gas needs, it may over time become less sensitive to what happens politically in the Middle East. And that has all sorts of ramifications as well.
Yeah, well, I think that is very much on the minds of some of the Gulf countries right now. You wouldn't see it because of the tension involved with Iran and its nuclear program. But I think that the countries in the region worry about that. I think it's one of the factors in this kind of astonishing thing in which the United Arab Emirates, one of the major oil producers, one of the major Gulf countries, along with Bahrain, now has a peace treaty with Israel, which would have been unthinkable, say, 4 months ago, would not have been expected. So that's, I think, one consequence that saying, you know, that these countries have to be more cooperative with each other to deal with the other threats in the region, as well as the economic opportunities. But I think it is, it is different. And even you see Saudi Arabia, which, you know, has been one of America's most important allies in the Middle East, one of its two major allies, has also developed a new relationship with a surprising partner called Russia and Vladimir Putin. I have a wonderful picture in the book of Vladimir Putin visiting with the king of Saudi Arabia and giving him a huge Arctic falcon, which is, you know, they love falconry in the Arab world, and as kind of a symbol of their partnership.
And Russia itself remains a key player as we head into the 21st century, Daniel, in the sense that it's a relatively small economy, but it's a nuclear power still, obviously, but also a huge petrol or gas station, if you will, supplying a huge amount of Europe's gas needs and increasingly, and here's another power play at work, increasingly supplying China's gas needs.
Yes, it's you're so right, Vincent, to note that sometimes one forgets that this Russian economy is only slightly bigger than that of Spain, and Spain ceased being a great power in the 18th century, and yet Vladimir Putin, the skillful judo player, as I call him, a judoist, he plays judo rather than chess in international politics, has put Russia back as a great power. And right now, huge controversy surrounding Russian gas exports to Europe, and in particular, a pipeline called Nord Stream 2, which runs under the Baltic Sea from Russia to Germany, 3 weeks from being completed, and U.S. sanctions have kind of stopped it from being completed. But at the same time that those sanctions went into effect, Vladimir Putin and his self-described best friend, Xi Jinping, the president of China, had this elaborate ceremony in different parts of Russia and China where they pulled the switch to start the flow of natural gas through this huge pipeline called the Power of Siberia. And I think that energy element is very important element. It's not the whole thing in this kind of growing alliance between Russia and China. And, you know, I've seen it up close when I was in St. Petersburg, and there was a program with President Putin and President Xi, and President Putin apologized to President Xi, said, "I'm sorry I kept you talking up till 4 a.m. in the morning your time talking." And Xi said, "We never have enough time to talk." So those two guys and those two countries have really gotten together, and that's a very geopolitical significance. If I could just say, Vincent, one of the great pictures in the book shows Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping, the president of China, making Russian pancakes. And Putin is explaining to Xi how you make Russian pancakes, which are called blini. And of course, while they were cooking up the pancakes, they were also cooking up other things. Chinese troops, for the first time, were participating in a massive Russian energy military exercise, which kind of all symbolize this shifting balance of power that you've been talking about in the world.
Our guest here on News Talk is Daniel Yergin, Pulitzer Prize winner and author of The New Map, Energy, Climate and Clash of Nations. Now, I suppose one of the other key factors in this evolving world, Daniel, that may actually change these relationships again and perhaps reduce some of the geopolitical sensitivities is if the world becomes more, if it can develop more renewable energy and become less dependent on traditional fossil fuels of oil and gas. And we've seen China very recently surprise the world by saying it has now set a target for being carbon neutral by 2060, which would be both an amazing achievement in its own right, but also perhaps change those relationships with Russia and perhaps make it less
sensitive.
Well,
that was a very dramatic statement that President Xi made. He did it at the United Nations. I think it was also a very deliberate geopolitical point of view because China is seeking, in contrast to the Trump presidency, to say, oh, we're the leader of globalization, we're the leader of the global community, rather than what has been the Trump administration, which is, you know, America first, we're going to go it alone, and particularly wrapping itself around climate. But I think for China, climate is not only about climate in the sense we think about it in Europe or in Ireland or in the United States, or Canada, but it's also about urban pollution, which is a huge problem in China. And so addressing climate is also a way to address urban pollution. And I think there's no question that renewables is a growing business. Many utilities are aiming to be by 2035 or 2050 net carbon zero. And indeed, that's the objective of the new president of the European Union, Ursula von Leyen. She has set that out as her objective. So I think we're going to see a lot more spending and development of renewables. So that will change the energy mix over time. But I should say one thing. One country that would be a big winner from that happens to be China, because 70% of solar panels are made in China and another 10% by Chinese companies elsewhere. They dominate what's called the lithium-ion battery supply chain, which you need for electric cars, rare earths, and so forth. So China's kind of well-positioned to take advantage of the shift to renewables.
So at one level, if China is serious, and we know being an autocracy, it can do what it requires to do to meet targets. If it's serious about these targets, and if perhaps a Biden administration comes in the coming weeks and changes the United States' view on the Paris Accord and signs up to it, perhaps renewable energy and even power sources like hydrogen could become a much more significant factor in this global mix and perhaps make the dependence on fossil fuels almost redundant within the next 20 years?
Well, I don't think redundant. I think for, you know, like in the United States, the average car stays on the road for 12 years. So I think it's going to be a more mixed picture. We'll have a lot more renewables. I think hydrogen, a lot of interest in hydrogen. I think it's still early stage, but, you know, I've just noticed every company that one runs into is now looking at hydrogen and saying what role, but it would take 10 or 20 years to unfold that. But I think there's no question, would you say, that President Biden would immediately rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement. No question about that. And he has a $2 trillion climate plan. So you would see an acceleration of renewables. So the mix will change and there'll be more renewables. But remember, wind and solar, you know, you can't put that into your petrol tank, your gasoline tank. That is really replacing coal and competing with natural gas for power generation and nuclear, where they're still building nuclear.
Leaving the very urgent environmental targets that we should try to achieve, Daniel, you seem to think that this transition from fossil fuels is going to take longer than perhaps it should, but in reality, it will.
If I can say, Vince, I think one other part of it, if I can just jump in here, is that one part of what we're going to need, I really think the answers are technology. With a colleague, former Energy Secretary Moniz, did a study for Bill Gates Foundation about all the technologies we don't have that we need. And one part of the technology we need is what's called carbon capture, because if we are continuing to use oil and gas, we're going to have to find ways to capture and even use the carbon. And so, you know, the real answers here are going to come out of technology that will kind of get us to where we all want to go.
You could argue as well, Daniel, that one of the key resources that could cause huge geopolitical shifts through the 21st century and that could cause many, many tensions and already beginning to do so is actually water.
Yes. I mean, people point to water and particularly desertification and the impacts that has on migration. If you think about people coming from Africa, into Europe and so forth. I don't see water as a source of regional conflict, like Ethiopia versus Egypt right now. I don't see it as I see water as a problem, but I don't see it as a sort of global conflictual problem because of its local and regional nature.
Are you basically optimistic as we head into the third decade of the 21st century? Because you say that we'll still be extracting large quantities of fossil fuels for decades to power the world's economies, and we possibly will go to war over them. And we know in the 21st century, if wars start for resources, they could get out of hand very quickly.
Well, I do worry. I mean, by nature, I'm an optimist, and I do think that, the two, in the conclusion of the new map, I go through all of this amazing surprises that have happened in the last 10 or 12 years, from shale to the falling costs of solar to financial crisis to the impact of the Paris Climate Agreement, and of course, COVID on top of it all. You go through the list, but I see two big issues that we'll be dealing with in the decades ahead. One is climate. And the other is what I call this clash of nations, and in particular, worry about the prudent management of relations with China, both by the U.S. and by Europe. But I am also struck that, technology and innovation responds to need. I was just on a call. I'm on the advisory board at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology Energy Initiative, and I just got off it to join you all. I'm just amazed by the amount of incredible creativity and scientific ingenuity that's going into trying to address climate. So I think we will, there will be solutions that we need that will work at scale, but they'll take time to unfold. But I think that's where the true emphasis needs to be. U.S. Department of Energy spends $6.5 billion a year on basic science, and you build it up from basic science. So that's why I'm an optimist, because, energy has been in transition since 1709, since an iron metal worker in Shropshire in England figured out how to use coal instead of wood to make better iron, and it's been evolving since. And I think we're going to see an acceleration. We're living in an acceleration of the energy transition.
And I'm glad to hear that you are optimistic, broadly speaking, about the years ahead. I might conclude by, you do feel that we are at a very challenging point in terms of the changing relationship between the United States and China, the dominant player, and I suppose the key challenger, almost like Britain and Germany before the First World War. And we all need to work hard to make sure that same outcome doesn't ensue.
I think that's so true, Vincent, that when I hear people talk about great power competition and strategic rivalry, it really does echo of that decade before the First World War, which the world stumbled into by accident. And so I think what you have emphasized is a central point, which is the prudent, stable, predictable management of relations and not have volatility in it, and find areas where you can work together, like climate, and avoid getting into a spiral where, it becomes tit for tat and you lose that ability to come together. And, and we are very knit together as a world, and sometimes we have to remember that and work together. So I think that's going to be, if there's a new administration in the United States in January, I think the top issue is going to be how to manage prudently relations with China. And that applies to Europe as well. I think we need countries working together rather than going it alone.
And basically focusing on providing sufficient energy needs as well, so that doesn't become the spark. A fascinating topic over the years ahead, but we'll leave it there. That's Daniel Yergin, Pulitzer Prize winner and author of The New Map, Energy, Climate and Clash of Nations. Daniel, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be with you. Thank you.
Taking Stock on News Talk.
Thanks to Skillnet Ireland, driving business success through innovative training and upskilling.